As You Wish Talk Radio. I'm James Gilland, your host, and we've got another great show tonight. I wanted to cover a couple things first for people that are, you know, going through a lot of these changes. I think they had 4 feet of hail near Texas, and, you know, they're just having crazy tornadoes and earthquakes around the world right now. You know, as a lot of people are still saying, you know, there aren't going to be any earth changes out there. So, you know, with these channel messages, but I think it's time for reality check on that one, because we are in the middle of these earth changes, and we are getting closer to 2012, the ending of the Mayan calendar, supposedly. And, you know, there's a lot of things on the horizon that are happening. I'm seeing change on every level. But anyway, I've got a great guest. I've got James Strait. He has a professional career, began in special forces as a soldier, where he demonstrated youthful tenacity and versatility by becoming the youngest recruit to graduate special forces training group. After military, joined a 30-year career as a professional pilot, flying over 100 different types of categories of airplanes. In parallel, Mr. Strait operated a small business, providing a variety of services to civilian companies and the military. After retirement from professional aviation, Mr. Strait transitioned into broadcast radio, where he's hosted Strait Talks Radio since 2006. He began his professional writing career with the release of Weird Missouri in 2008, and his most recent book, Deja Vu, All Over Again, is an action-adventure novel taking place in the final 57 hours prior to the calendar ending in 2012, December 21st. So without any further ado, we want to welcome James to the show. James, are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you.
You know, it's quite an interesting arena to go into, this 2012.
Isn't it?
I'd love to hear, you know, what your take is on pretty much what's unfolding now and what seems to be coming up in the future.
Yeah. Well, as far as 2012 goes and the significance of you know, December 21st, the research that I did into the Mayan calendar was, honestly, it was minimal. And I did enough to make the content of the story in Deja Vu All Over Again accurate when you relate it to the calendar. But I'm anything but an expert on a Mayan history or their calendar system. But, you know, the world is a big, complex place, and there are a lot of things happening that are, some of them are explainable, some of them not. And I do know that as we approach December 21st, if for no other reasons than it is a marketable thing for the mass media, we're going to see a lot of stuff about December 21st, the significance of it. You're going to see lots of talking heads on all the cable programs, and they're going to run any kind of documentary or action-adventure movie or anything that Hollywood has produced that relates to December 21st, 2012, you will see it, and you're going to see it over and over again, especially as the fall comes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't have a TV up here, and so we have the luxury of missing all this, and I haven't really watched TV since 1976 when I tossed it pretty much out the window. But although there are some good shows on there, you know, Discovery Channel has some good shows in the History Channel now and then, but I really don't miss it in the least. But you know, what do you think? I mean, there are so many things going on. I know we're coming into an alignment with galactic plane, and I know the Russian scientist Dmitry, he's been talking about this huge energy cloud that we're moving into. We're moving into it, like we're moving into it right now, and it does seem that there's a lot more energy going on, especially with the sun, you know, throwing off its coronal mass ejections and flares, which are one of the driving forces behind the severe weather and the increase in earthquake and volcanic activity. But you know, just the science alone does seem to be pointing towards some major events coming up in our very near future.
Yeah, I guess you're talking about the galactic beam.
Yeah, well, they call the one galactic plane, I guess it is. It's right. I guess it's the beam coming off the center, like galactic core, the right. The black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting year. That I'm certain of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been watching. You get these reports like Dutch Sense and a lot of these other people putting out these continuous reports, and some people say, well, that's just because the internet now, why you have so much more information and things like that. And I tell them, I go, well, you know, I'm just looking at nature. I spend a lot of time outdoors in nature and watching the weather patterns and watching the earthquake, you know, the increase in earthquake and volcanic activity and everything else. And that I don't think it has anything to do with the internet. I mean, these are natural events that are unfolding.
Yeah, I guess if you're outdoors and if you want to have an indicator as to what might be on the horizon, is pay attention to the animals, pay attention to the behavior of the animals.
Yeah, here we watch the ant hills. When we have these fire ants here up in the forest, and when they make their big hills, we know it's going to be a hard winter. You know, so
fire ants. You know, I'm glad we don't have those.
Yeah, they're. I actually just take my tractor out and move their hills every now and then. You know, when they put them in a place we don't want them.
Right.
But there's some major events seem to be coming up on the horizon. I'm curious, in your it says in your resume here that you've owned all kinds of categories of all different types of airplanes. In all of that airtime you've had, you know, have you seen anything like any UFOs or any things that you just couldn't account for?
Yeah, you know, I've been asked that question many times, and to give your listeners some perspective, I flew for 30 years. The majority of my flying was done at night, and I have seen many things in the air that I could not identify. Now, quite honestly, I am a very cautious skeptic, and the caution is given to myself to remember that these things could be true. But anything I've seen in the air, I could explain in the sense that if I saw something off in the distance, a light in the sky, I could query air traffic control, and I'd ask them, do you see something off at 2 o'clock, you know, about 15 miles or something? And they could tell me what it was. But there's also been things that I can't explain, but in all honesty, that doesn't mean that I interpreted it to be a UFO in the sense that it was a ship from another planet. It was just something in the night sky that I could not identify. But I think, you know, with so much air traffic out there now, and especially over the continental U.S. and Europe, it's very easy to look up into the sky at any point in time, night or day, and see something that's difficult to understand, whether it's, you know, something that's orbiting in space or something, you know, in our terrestrial atmosphere. It's very easy to be confused by what's in the sky.
It seems most of the things, even military, they need to have a strobe and a running light, you know, unless they're in pursuit of something, if they're in the air. And so when you see one just brilliant light, there's one of two things. Either it's not, you know, a standard aircraft or military, or it's got its landing lights on and it's coming right at you. You know?
Yeah, they have things called identifying lights too, so they're just easy for airplanes to see one another in the air. And
yeah,
those at a distance can look like a single light, or they can look like two very intense, you know, bright lights flying side by side, which indeed they are. But now, you know, there's a multitude of stories I can share with you from my research doing Weird Missouri that involve conversations with people who had lifelong experiences with UFOs and things that they could not explain. And they put in a couple instances, a lifetime of research into trying to get an understanding of what they'd been experiencing. And I can give you the short version, which will tell you that they spent that time bringing in all kinds of scientific measuring equipment and doing very detailed analysis of the minimal trace evidence they had, and they ultimately ended up with no answer to their mystery. But the mystery itself, the experiences they had were stunning. I talked to a fellow in southern Missouri, right down by the Arkansas border, who had been experiencing anomalous lights in the night sky over his property for about 30 years. He owned a 400-acre cattle ranch down near the Arkansas border. He's the banker of the town here. He's the president of the bank in town. He's a very serious, very normal guy, very likable guy. He and I got along wonderfully from the get-go. I spent about 3 hours with him. And he dragged out two great large containers full of photo albums of photographs of things he had seen in the night sky. Pictures of those are in Weird, Missouri. And he had hundreds of photographs of these lights in the night sky. And he said a typical scenario would be a single bright light would come out of the Arkansas night sky, come over his property. He felt it was hovering at about 10 to 12,000 feet. Then several smaller bright lights would drop out of that initial big bright light, and then they'd all shoot off out to all points on the horizon. And then the big light would just dim out and go away. And within 5 minutes, he said that it was like clockwork, Air Force interceptors would arrive and start orbiting the area. And he'd seen this, you know, for 25 years. And he had a crop circle on his property. There's a picture of that in Weird, Missouri. And when I talked to all these people, and I talked to multitudes of people about these types of topics, I was always trying to assess whether they were in any way trying to pull the wool over my eyes or to exaggerate or embellish or just in some way try to trip me up. And fortunately, and it was a really rewarding experience to interact with these people, because none of them were doing that. They were all just honest people who had seen inexplicable things and felt compelled to share it with me. And so I felt honored about that. But at the same time, you could see at some level, even though that they were very normal in their presentation, at some level you could sense that they were bothered by it. They were moved by it. They were they wanted a solution to it. And unfortunately for them, they just didn't come up with any answers.
Yeah, we have a similar occurrence here. It's quite interesting because when I first came here to the ranch, I had no idea that there was a long history of UFO activity here. Even going back to Kenneth Arnold, who's, you know, he lost sight of the ships when they descended on the western slopes of Mount Adams, which is actually my front yard, you know, so... Dr. J. Allen Hynek, all of these guys have been up here investigating these objects, and I started seeing them flying around here, and so finally I told a few people about it, and they started looking at me sideways and thinking I was nuts, and the whole nine yards, and so finally I just got a video camera and started videotaping a lot of it, I go, hey, look, it's, watch the video. It speaks for itself. Don't take my word for it or anything else. Come and see yourself. And boy, since then we've had, I don't know, thousands of people come up here and people from every walk of life, including, you know, triple PhD Boeing engineers and Lockheed engineers and who had their own sightings and actually filmed the objects themselves.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing how people from all walks of life have a shared interest in that. There actually, that same kind of behavior was taking place on this fellow's farm in southern Missouri. Mm-hmm. He actually went to the point of building a large deck on the back of his barn. And since he was a cattle rancher, he could butcher cattle. He'd cut up steaks for everybody. They'd get 50 or 100 people over, and they'd barbecue steaks and wait for the lights to arrive in the night sky. And they'd have a party watching this stuff. None of them could explain it. But, you know, you mentioned bringing in, people with scientific backgrounds to try to figure things out. There was a lady named Joanne Scarpellini that I talked to for about 2 hours one day. And she was a PhD chemist who had spent her entire life as a very analytical person. And at the time I talked to her, which was about 5 years ago, she was about 75 years old. But she and her husband had been going out to investigate the Joplin spook light. And Joplin, Missouri is in the southwestern corner of Missouri, almost on the Kansas border. And there's a light out there that has been very predictable in its behavior for the last 75 or 80 years. And she went out there literally for 50 years. She's been out to it hundreds of times, taking every kind of scientific measuring device you can think of, trying to get an understanding of what this light is. And she had been asked to go down to this gentleman's cattle ranch. She and the owner of the ranch became very friendly, and she's been down there many times. She's taken all of her measuring equipment down there, and she's documented as best she can, but she has no idea what it is either. And but it's amazing how you can get people who you might think, because of their scientific acumen and their background and their education, might be hardcore skeptics, are very interested in trying to find out what this stuff is, and they're very open-minded to it.
Yeah, I'm surprised that I tell you what's really interesting in the UFO field. There are, you know, it's it's a tough. I'm trying to say this, you know, candidly, but there are people that are very serious. They want to figure out what this is. They're very serious researchers, and you know, good solid people. And then there's other groups in there that are, you know, have different agendas and have different programs going, and they have belief systems, and you know, they have a piece of the pie, and they're holding on to that piece so tightly, trying to sell everybody, you know, the whole pie when they only have a piece of the pie. But it's quite an interesting venue there. And then, as you're saying, I love these other people. They're just having an experience. They're trying to share it, you know, with others. And then they're saying, hey, give me an explanation for this. You know, bring out your equipment, bring out whatever you got. Let's figure this thing out.
Right. Are you familiar with a fellow named Bob White?
I know the name.
Yeah. Well, Bob White is a fellow who was on the way. He was in Colorado. He was on his way to Denver with a buddy of his, and they were very close to Denver. But there, it was an evening. They noticed a strange light hovering over the countryside. So they pulled over to watch, and they stood watching it for a few minutes, and then some really extremely bright, almost incandescently bright, piece of material fell away from this craft. And a craft shot off at extreme speed. And he very carefully took a bearing on where a piece of debris fell. And he actually walked out into the fields and found this piece of whatever it was that fell off the aircraft. Mm-hmm. Now, this piece of material is actually, there's a picture of it in Weird, Missouri. And Bob White created, based upon this piece of material, in that event changed his life forever, because he wound up creating the Missouri Museum for the Unexplained, and that museum dealt with a lot of UFO and paranormal type things. But his whole career as a UFOologist and a paranormalist was predicated on the significance of this piece of material. And this piece of material is about a foot long, and it looks like it's made of aluminum, like a hybrid lumen carbon look to it. And it looks like if you were to take a piece of material and allow it to enter the Earth's atmosphere, and as it became molten, it would flow back on itself, creating like almost a welded type thing where you stack nickels on top of one another to create a nice weld. That kind of feathering process goes back, and the thing almost looks like a metal carrot. Now, he had the integrity to, because people were challenging about, you know, the origins of it, and he actually sent it off to the National Institute for Discovery Science and also the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology to have it tested to see what kind of material it was, because he was convinced it was extraterrestrial. Now, both of those entities described the alloy precisely the same. They were both unaware that the other was testing it, and it turned out to be a terrestrial entity called Alloy 360. And whatever Bob White saw that evening, even though this particular piece of debris that fell off of it is a terrestrial alloy, it was a very high performance machine. So, what's the origins of that? That's maybe a more interesting question.
Yeah, I know from inside information and people that were involved in some of the back engineering projects that, you know, we have some pretty interesting toys up there flying around, and they could be easily mistaken for some off-world craft.
Yeah, there's a lot of, sure, you know, the modern jets now, the modern fighters, they're capable of such extreme maneuvers that if somebody were to see one at high altitude, even in the daytime, doing what they can do, they can do almost right angle turns now, you could confuse someone and think, well, because, you know, intuitively, based upon what most people think an airplane can do, if they witness that, they're going to say, that can't be an airplane. But indeed it is, because modern airplanes can do some amazing things now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen some pretty weird things up here where actually one whatever you want to call it, UFO ship, vehicle, whatever it is, will actually morph into three. And you see one object there, and all of a sudden it morphs into three, and it's sitting there as three objects, and it morphs back into one, and then it appears three more on the other side, you know, and and does that for about 15 minutes back and forth, and then morphs into a whole bunch of objects and then starts scouring the mountain, you know, moving all over the mountain here.
Right. And you've seen this?
Yeah, we have it on film, actually.
Really? See, I talk to people who've seen these things, and I've never seen anything like that. I'd love to see something like that.
Yeah, we have that. I'll send you a video. I'll send you a DVD on that.
Yeah,
I'll get your address later, and I'll shoot it to you. But
yeah,
we've got some crazy stuff that's just not explainable. Even objects coming up. We had Paranormal State here, and you know, they did a special on the ranch, and you know, they're pretty skeptical at first, and then all of a sudden they started seeing all kinds of crazy things happen here. You know, paranormal things and you know, the UFOs, and then their psychic Chip Coffee that went out with them told them that, you know, he felt a presence, you know, a very strong extraterrestrial. He said it's them. They're from out there. They're not from here. And that was kind of interesting. He said about 10 o'clock tonight in the east, you're going to see a ship. Well, what's really bizarre is that they did their interview with him. I was nowhere near where they did the interview. It was out on another part of the ranch. And then they called me in for the interview, and I told them the exact same thing. I said, at 10 o'clock, have your cameras ready in the east and a little more towards the mountain. And I said, we're going to have some activity. So they actually admitted that at 10 o'clock on the show that they said, hey, James and Chip did say 10 o'clock in the east, and a huge ship just powered up, lit up the sky, and then took off towards the mountain and went down below the trees and made a nice turn and went off, towards the, it was going, it appeared in the east, it was going north, and it ended up going east. So it made a nice turn, you know, just above the treetops.
Yeah, when you mentioned treetops, the farmer in southern Missouri also related a story to me where he was on his back porch at night, and a bright light, he had a tree line about 1,000 feet behind his house, mm-hmm. and behind the tree line, all of a sudden this bright light started to glow, and it was very strange looking like this. He said it was almost like a Spielberg looking thing. And he's a very interesting guy, because I think I would be very reluctant to go out towards it, but he said he just started walking towards it. And he got about halfway to it, and then it went out. And then the next morning he went out, and that's when he discovered the crop circle. And there's a picture mm-hmm. of the crop circle in Weird Missouri also. And, so the lights behind the trees and the craft, you know, descending behind a tree line, I would love to see something like that. And I live out in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania, and I never see anything. Although in this area, about 2 years ago, there was tons of UFO activity. People saw UFOs for weeks. I've never seen any. It's just like they avoid me for some reason. I don't know.
You know what I find out is if you actually do your own intention experiment and you meditate on them and ask, and if you're coming from the heart and you ask, you know, with the real, you know, pure intentions, an open mind, loving heart, you'd be surprised. I see people that have never seen anything, and they'll come and they'll sit down and do a little meditation and then have some incredible experiences. We had one major UFO investigator. I don't want to mention his name because he'd get a little upset. But, you know, he came up to the ranch and he says, you know, if this isn't for real, I'm going to debunk you. Uh-huh. And I started laughing. And he goes, what's so funny? I said, it's not between you and me. It's between you and them. And so I said, I think you need to go pull a chair up and sit out in the field and make your peace with them and meditate, you know. So, and then I just closed the door. And so he was just standing there, you know, like, God, I drove, you know, I drove 600 miles for this, you know, to have a door shut in my face. Right. And I was watching him to see what he did. And he grabbed a chair and he went out there and, you know, he told him, he said, if this is for real, I'll be your strongest supporter. You know, I said, I just need to know that this is for real. And he was out there, you know, just having his own little conversation, and two ships just came in and appeared out of nowhere and flew right over his head. And, you know, that was it. We, you know, we couldn't get rid of him after that. He was up here over and over again.
Yeah. I think if two ships came that close to me and they appeared over my head, I might be very interested from that point forward also.
Yeah. But, if you go to East City Stargate, you can see some of this footage, or if you go to the East City website, the Paranormal State, footage is on there, as well as the BBC documentary where they saw the ships as well. But, you know, there's a lot of footage on there that's pretty hard to deny. I mean, everybody, you can always deny anything, basically. But, you know, sometimes, you know, it's the obvious. If you, you know, if the thing lights up the whole sky and does a right angle turn and you feel a pulse of energy go through you, you know, it's probably not something we have, you know.
Yeah, one of the dilemmas that we all face with the internet, and unfortunately, there are countless people out there who have extreme technical skill and can make anything appear to look any way they want it to look. And
the people that
do that are doing a huge disservice to all the people that are trying to find the truth. And so the problem with the data, the video data that you see on the internet, and the pictorial data that you see on the internet, the problem with it is that it's pictorial and video data on the internet. It's all become suspect. And but on the other end of that, I like talking to people who are truth seekers, but are also the first one to debunk something, because when somebody that does it, that's their style of investigation, when they finally do say, hey, listen, this is the real deal, I'm prone to listen to them.
You know, I've always told people that, you know, if you do have a real event, like a major sighting with a lot of people, I guess just recently, St. Petersburg over in Russia, I guess, had a lot of major activity, and it's all over the internet. You know, the same thing about the one over the Dome of the Rock. As soon as some footage came out, and there was two or three that seemed to corroborate each other and that seemed to be real, the internet was just flooded with CGIs and fakes and all kinds of other things. And you know, I think there's certain agencies, that's what they do, as well as just people out there
having fun.
Yeah. But it's really interesting that what I've seen is the best ones, the best footage throw out usually. You know, the ones that actually show the craft and the windows and the guy waving through the window, you know, or the really clear ones, those are the ones that are usually the CGIs,
right?
You know, the faked ones, because most of the real footage, the real UFOs are very they're very hard to film just because of the energy fields around them, and some of them are not, they don't seem to be fully physical. They always seem to be a little blurry or fuzzy. And that just comes with the nature of the ships itself.
Yeah, you know, I looked at hundreds of photographs that this farmer in southern Missouri had taken over about a 25-year period, and they seemed to come in three different categories. And they were very typically in either groups of two or three. They would be like a U-shaped band of three, which one each band, you know, each U-shaped, you know, casket or fitting into the other. Then there'd be others that were just a slightly bowed, very bright band of light. And then they had spherical shapes. And all of his were of about the same quality, which was actually pretty good quality considering the fact that, you know, he was using, and most of these pictures were taken before digital cameras were available. Some of them are actually pretty good, and I took pictures of what I thought were the best ones, and they're in the book Weird Missouri. But you know, I thought it was interesting that the lights that he'd seen were very consistent in their appearance over a 25-year period. So, you know, what's causing them? I don't know. He doesn't know. He would love to know. I would love to know. You would love to know. But it's a very difficult type of phenomenon to get any, you know, tactile data on. So it's got the world thinking. That's for sure.
Yeah, I noticed that, you know, the same thing with the channeling and all the other stuff. You know, I actually went through the Tibetan Foundation back in the 70s and was one of their best channels at the time. And I got out of it because it was so full of fraud and people that weren't trained, that didn't know what they're doing. And so a lot of the spiritual messages around the UFOs and the objects, you know, it's very tough to find the information that really that has any physical evidence to back it up. And I'm not trying to diss people, you know, that are having spiritual experiences. You know, I've had my own spiritual experiences, but it would be great to have, you know, if you're channeling, you know, these beings, you know, that have these giant motherships and smaller shuttles and things like that, just say, hey, come on down and let's take a photograph. You know, and if they're flying over your place or in communication with you, you would think they would have some kind of photographic evidence or any other evidence. I mean, there is technology now that can actually photograph the light spectrum, any changes within the electromagnetic light spectrum, and any changes in the infrared and any of these things. And it would be nice to start deploying a lot of this technology to see, you know, if there really is something going on, or is this just an overactive imagination?
Yeah, you mentioned channels. Are you familiar with the name Pearl Lenore Curran, Curran?
No, I'm not.
She was a Missouri lady who lived back. She was born in the late 1800s, and she did most of her channeling during the early part of the 20th century. And she channeled a 17th century spinster named Patience Worth. And she did this through a process called automatic writing. And she would sit down at a table with a pencil and paper, and she would just allow her hand to lay on top of the paper, and then her hand would just start writing. And in one seven-year period, she dictated more than 2 million words written by hand. In her lifetime channeling Patience Worth, she wrote almost 4.5 million words. And she would write it in a language, an archaic language that very few people would be familiar with. And she wrote it in using perfect archaic grammar. And she had no exposure to that language anywhere in her educational process. And she was a very fascinating lady who had this amazing ability to write in a style that a lot of people compare to Chaucer and Shakespeare. And she had a very average education, no college. And so for her to be able to do this, I think was an amazing thing. And I put about a, it's one of the larger stories in Weird Missouri is the topic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying, as I said, I'm not trying to diss channeling or, you know, because I was involved in it. Actually, I've written some channeled books, you know, and they've turned out to be very accurate, unfortunately, because they were talking about a lot of the earth changes and, you know, the international banksters and all the other stuff that was coming up in the future. But this was all written back in 82. You know, it even covered the sun, you know, the expanding sun and the escalation in earthquake and volcanic activity, all of that. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, I really do believe we are interdimensional beings ourselves. We're not just a body and a personality. We're a spirit that has a body and a personality, and that spirit's eternal. And there's many levels to that spirit. It's been on many different dimensions. So, you know, you get into that area, you know, it gets pretty crazy. But, you know, how do you bring that back to the physical and make it understandable to somebody that thinks they're a body and a personality, you know?
Yeah, well, you may be onto something, because I've felt out of phase with the rest of the human race for my entire life.
Yeah. I tell you what, I found out that people have a strong interest in the paranormal, especially UFOs. One of the reasons why is because they have a history. On a soul level, they were them, and they have a strong connection to different realms and different realities, and you know, and you can even see it in their genetics sometimes. It's really interesting in people's structures, because, you know, I think we do inherit, you know, genetics from our family, but the soul also kind of alters those genetics as we grow and changes them, you know, puts their changes in them as well. But, yeah, it's quite interesting when you look at the big picture.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's very possible that in our DNA we do have vestiges of if not our past existence, of something that that was handed down to us that we recognize in modern times or in our lifetime as being significant. And I actually think that is maybe one possible explanation for deja vu. And but, you know, you're a minister, correct?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the 1941 UFO incident that involved a minister?
What was his name?
Well, his name was William Huffman.
I have heard of that. I think I have. Can you go further into that? Tell me a little bit more about the story.
Yeah, it's interesting to UFO folks because it happened 6 years before Roswell. And in Cape Girardeau, Missouri is in the very southeastern corner of the state. And in 1941, Reverend William Huffman was approached by local authorities one evening, and they asked him to come out to a crash site. And the premise was that they wanted him to give last rites to the deceased at the site. And he, of course, agreed to do that, and they traveled out to the site. And he said that when he got to the site, he expected to see a police presence and probably a fire element there, fire trucks. But he did not expect to see the U.S. military, and he did not expect to see the FBI. So when they arrived at the site, the FBI approaches him and said, well, this is what we'd like you to do. There's a crash site over here that we'd like you to go over and give last rites to the entities inside. And he was a little bit taken back by the language, but he agreed to go over there. And when he got to the site, he saw some kind of a vessel that he did not recognize. And of course, when airplanes crash, they can be mangled and unrecognizable. But this evidently was still intact to the point where it did not look terrestrial to him. You know, and it was ruptured, and he could see inside the ship, and he saw three deceased, obviously non-human entities. And he also noticed that inside the ship was instrumentation that was strange and had placarding that would be something that he compared to hieroglyphics. But even though he was, you know, taken back by all this, he gave them last rites, and he came back and reported to the authorities that had confronted him there, and they said that thank you for doing what you did, but you've just taken part in a classified operation. It's national security. You're not to breathe a word of this to anybody ever. And he agreed to that, and then he went home and immediately told his wife. So she had him trained.
Yeah.
Now, this story, she kept it secret, and the reverend died, and then later the wife died, and on her deathbed, she related this story to her surviving relatives and to a reporter, and because it was a story related on her deathbed, it was taken as, sacrilege, or it was as being, truthful, and and maybe in today's world, we'd be skeptical about that, but back in, the late 40s, it was taken as a truthful story. Now, I haven't seen any of the Project Blue Book information, but it's my understanding that this story is in there, but that most of it is redacted. So, how is that meaningful? I don't know, but I always found it an interesting story.
Did they give any details about the occupants and what they look like or anything about the body type?
The information I got was that they were just small, obviously non-human entities. Now, were they, the gray skin type or, what I don't know any of that. But it was just clear to him that these were not human beings.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about weird Missouri. My mom's from Missouri.
Is she?
So, and she's always had a gift, She's always been very gifted. People used to call her Wanda the Witch because she always had a real strong intuition about things. Kind of held it down, didn't want to utilize it or work with it much. But
what part of Missouri is she from?
Oh God, I'm trying to remember the town. It's a small little town. Yeah. I know it's not Joplin. It's near there.
I asked that because I spent I was born and raised in Missouri, but I left there when I went to the military. Then when I got out, I came out east, and I really never looked back until I went back to Right Weird, Missouri. And when you're a kid and you grow up in any area of any state, you know about maybe a 25-mile radius of it, and the rest of the state is a mystery to you. So for me, most of Missouri was still a mystery, 95% of it. So for me to go back and do the research, I went back for 8 weeks, drove 8,500 miles, went to about 250 different venues, talked to hundreds of people, and took 2,700 photographs, and then all came back to the East Coast, sat down for 3 months, and wrote the book. But in that discovery of Missouri, it was a marvelous process because I met so many interesting and really nice people. I fell in love with the people, and I fell in love with the state again. Mm-hmm. And so I became very familiar with certainly all the major cities and many of the smaller cities that wouldn't be, you know, common knowledge to even most Missourians. But if somebody can give me a city, I can put it in the geographic ballpark. So I just said, if you knew where your mom would be.
I'll have to ask her next time what the little town is that she was in. Yeah. It's probably a city by now. But
you never know.
Yeah. The now, is there other, there? I know there's a lot of strange lights and sightings. Has there been getting into any of the creature sightings that have happened there in Missouri?
Yeah, you know, in Missouri, all the creatures come under a kind of like an umbrella category called Momo, the Missouri Monster. And anytime anybody sees a creature they cannot identify, whether it falls into the, you know, the Sasquatch, Yeti, Bigfoot category or another, it gets, you know, gets lumped into the Momo genre. And I talked to probably half a dozen people who had seen Bigfoot. Typically, half the time it was folks who had been fishing along either the Missouri or the Osage or the Merrimack River, and they had seen either trace evidence in the form of footprint or a clump of hair along the river side. Or one gentleman had saw was fishing, and he looked into the trees, and he thought he saw a Bigfoot essentially leaning back on the trunk of a tree, just resting. And again, another bold fellow, he got out of his boat and actually walked up towards where he thought this entity was. And then as he got closer, he realized that it was just the shapes of the branches and the shadows and the lighting had, you know, had just tricked his eye for a little while. But the most interesting story about Bigfoot that I learned in Missouri was by a soldier who was in the back of a 2.5-ton truck going out to a rifle range on Fort Leonardwood, Missouri. And they had pulled up to a 4-way intersection, were just pulling away, and as they pulled away, out from the side of the road walks about a 7-foot tall, hairy, beast-like looking animal that had a human configuration, but was clearly not human. And he said this thing just stood in the middle of the road and watched the truck pull away, and the Sasquatch or whatever it was, seemed to have no care in the world that it had been seen. It had its body language was completely relaxed, and that the soldier had no sense that there was any kind of malevolent force going on, or that there was any danger involved. It was just this strange-looking entity walk right out to the middle of the road and watch the truck pull away.
Yeah. We have same instances here. We have right behind us is Skamania, which is right next to the Mount Adams. And they have all kinds of researchers out here and people have written books and psychologists. And a lot of the locals here, when you talk to the locals, there's no doubt. You know, they said, oh, yeah, you know, it's out there. And a lot of the hunters have seen it. We have lava tubes all through this place. There's just massive lava tubes, and I've been in some of them. And I was in one, I guess about maybe 8 months ago or so, and we never did find the end of that. It went from you know one cave and splitting off into two with a couple big rooms. And then it went off again down the road, and that one split off into two. And then you know now you've got like four different paths you can take. And finally, I just came back. I go, I don't have enough light, you know, or enough whatever to do this one or chalk or anything to show me, you know.
Yeah, lava tubes. I've never been in a lava tube. I'd like to do that. Now, Missouri is the second most cavernous state in the country. Tennessee is the most cavernous, but Missouri has 65 6,500 cataloged caves. They have 22 commercial caves. I've been into 7 of those commercial caves. I've been into 2 privately owned caves. And then I've been into a cave that less than 100 people have been into at least 4 years ago. And I think you'll find this story fascinating because it's really weird. The timing of it is extraordinary because on the morning of 9/11, the Greene County Highway Department was drilling a 13-hole blasting pattern in the roadside, or actually the countryside along a road. They're going to widen the road in Greene County just south of Springfield, Missouri, which is in the southwestern part of the state. And they had drilled this blasting pattern. They had packed 3 of the holes full of explosives, and then the events of the morning of 9/11 happened. And not many people are aware of it, but within an hour or so after it was clear that it was a terrorist event, the government issued a nationwide cease blasting order. So they had packed these holes full of explosives, but they could not detonate them. They saw it as a safety hazard, and they petitioned for permission to get it. So the next day, they were allowed to detonate those 3 holes alone. And when they did that, it opened up a cave. Now, the Highway Department, the Department of Transportation, all across the state of Missouri, has a standard operating procedure. When they discover a new cave, they have to cease work. Then they have to call an archaeologist or a paleontologist. There's a small laundry list of people that they can call. Those people then come out, take a look at the cave, see if it has any significance as far as, you know, archaeologically or paleontologically. And if it does, then work ceases. If it's not, if it doesn't, then they just go on. Well, they called Mark Furr on the morning of the 9, actually the next day of 9/12. And they said, we've discovered this cave, and we need you to come out and take a look at it. Now, he had received a bunch of calls in his career. He's the executive director for the Missouri Science Museum, Natural Science Museum. And he had said that he'd always gone out to these new holes in the ground, and that's all they were. They were just a new cave. But he said he went out to this one. He parked his car. He walked about within 200 feet of the opening of the cave. And he said he stopped in his track because the hairs on the end of his on his arms were standing on end because he said, I smelled the ice age. And I thought that was a very powerful statement. So he said that he went into the cave. Within 10 minutes, he knew that he had found something incredibly significant. He stayed in there about 2 hours because he wanted people to believe him that he found something significant. He came out. He told them to close the place up. They ultimately put sheets of steel up against the opening, put in a 36-inch concrete tunnel that runs out horizontally 30 feet from the cave, then goes straight up 30 feet. They backfilled over all of that. It has a special locking manhole cover. And inside that cave are species that are unique to anywhere else on planet Earth. It's its own private, isolated, miniature universe. It's the oldest cave on the North American continent. It's 1.4 million years old. They've discovered hundreds of new species. I saw marks on the wall of the cave. It's a clay wall. That about 15 feet up on the wall, there are marks of the claws of a short-faced bear, which is a bear that's been extinct for about 15,000 years. But a short-faced bear was about 30% bigger than a grizzly. And this bear had been in there trying to probably find its way out. And the weird thing about that whole story, and a really, I think, amazing part of it, is the fact that had packed all 13 holes full of explosives, and had they detonated those 13 holes full of explosives, they would have destroyed the entire cave. So the events of the morning of 9/11, if there was any positive thing from it, which there isn't, but it's just, I think it's interesting that this cave was discovered because of the events of 9/11.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting story. Did they find any fossils or
yeah, and in fact, bones? When you go in there, actually, my son was spent a week in Missouri with me, and he was there with me when we got to go into the cave. And at the time, they had dug down about 4 feet into the floor of the cave, and you could see just layer after layer of sediment. And they had discovered hundreds of different species, thousands of fossils, and they had actually ceased any kind of excavation because he said, you know, there's so much in this cave. We're finding stuff every day, but we're also destroying stuff. I think in the not too distant future, there's going to be better techniques for excavating that will not be destructive. So we're ceasing all further exploration until the techniques improve. So yeah, they were finding stuff literally every day, new species every day. Hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. I've wondered, there's, I've heard about all these different, there's the Mothman, and then there's these upright wolf type creatures that like wolfmen, and I was wondering if they've had any of those sightings in Missouri.
Well, there's a couple of creatures that are more associated with folklore, because there's one called the Missouri Holler, and it's described as a hybrid cat dog type thing that no one I could find had actually seen it, but the description and the familiarity that the people I talked to had with it was that it was a nocturnal animal that had one hellacious howl to it when it let loose. And mm-hmm. if you've ever been to, you live out in the middle of nowhere. I do mm-hmm. too. And at night, sound can travel forever. I mean, mm-hmm. I my nearest neighbor is about a half a mile away. And at night, when it's quiet, I can hear them talking on their back porch, and I could share their conversation. It's amazing how sound. So you can imagine at night how some cat could let loose with some, mm-hmm. howl out in the Missouri Hollow, and it would just echo through the hollows. And so it's very easy to see how somebody could conjure up some kind of an amazing beast in their mind. And that's the uh-huh. that's a folklore part of the Missouri Holler. There's also another one called a booger dog. And that is described as an animal that is visible but has no tangible presence. It's something that, like if you were to throw something at it, it would pass right through it uh-huh. and it would be unaffected. But the booger dog is a headless animal. So, there's all kinds of those interesting stories that have been handed down across the generations. And, at some point in time, maybe it was birthed in some event that somebody saw, and it just scared the bejeebers out of them. And just like with any story, it gets exaggerated and escalated. Mm-hmm. It's just an incredible thing. But that becomes part of the folklore, and I think it's really interesting stuff.
Did you hear some of the stories about the Skinwalker Ranch?
No.
They have a story in there that these dogs, they look like wolves, but they're huge. They're very big. And they came into this guy's barn, and I guess they were trying to get one of his livestock. I don't know what it was. And he came out there, and he saw the thing trying to reach, through the bars and grab one of his livestock. And he had a 357 Magnum or something. And he emptied a few shots into this thing, and it just turned around and looked at him and walked away.
Yeah, that's time that's time for you to go somewhere else, because if a 357 won't put it down, it's time to leave.
Yeah, exactly. That's and this is a farmer out there, and he just said, I know I didn't miss, And he said, it just turned around and looked at me and – yeah.
Where is the Skinwalker Ranch?
It's in, it's in near Arizona. It's near Sedona, okay. Not too far from Sedona, Arizona. I don't know what town it's actually in, but it has a long history. They did a lot of research into it, and appearances of all kinds of different beings, and they had – they hooked up all these cameras with night vision and everything on cables, and buried the cables, a whole system of cables, to a manned station. And something came in and just tore all the cameras out, and these cables were buried pretty deep, and actually grabbed the cables and tore them right up out of the ground. So whatever it was there, one of the entities there did not want to be, filmed. Just a lot of just crazy things happening there. A lot of UFO activity, and just mainly strange lights and beings appearing there. It's some kind of a vortex or whatever.
Yeah, in Missouri, Jefferson City is the capital, and Jefferson City is in a lot of ways, in Missouri, is kind of the FedEx for UFOs. It's like, you know, all the UFOs come there at night, and then they all shoot out to different directions to do whatever they do. And a lot of people have seen so many strange things there. There's so many occurrences of it, so many sightings, that they've actually created different categories for a mothership and scout trip ships and patrol mm-hmm. ships, and, you know, the whole family of, you know, potential craft. And so the state capital is considered, like, you know, UFO Central in Missouri.
Yeah, I'm wondering why they are choosing that area. I mean, it might be the caves. There might be a large underground facility there. I know in our area they did some ground penetrating radar, and they found out there's just massive caverns underneath us.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting actually on top of one. We had a guy out here named David Farnsworth, who's, I think, his great grandfather, whatever, was Philo T. Farnsworth, who created the television set. But he had some crazy equipment here where he could monitor any activity, anything moving, anything magnetic. He just had this huge oscilloscope, and it was showing this whole band. And he goes, look at these things. They're moving, they're broadcasting energies. And he was showing me the whole thing. And he said, guess what? See this? And I said, yeah. And he said, that's going right under us right now. He said, there's an object with a huge magnetic field going underneath us at this, you know. And I go, well, that's interesting. So that kind of explains things. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's a big cave system there, if there isn't some kind of underground facility close by there.
Yeah, you know, when I went out there initially, I had done my homework at home, and I'd actually gotten a Missouri road map, and I had about 30 different locations that I knew I definitely wanted to go to. And my thinking was that at each location, I'd ask for, you know, do you know where anything strange or interesting is? And I'd just start chaining things together. And that's actually the way it worked out. But my first stop when I got there was a little town called Peavely, not too far away from St. Louis, about 30 miles southwest of St. Louis. And I had learned on by doing research on the internet that there was an underwater UFO base there. So I get my rental car at the airport, and I drive to Peabody, and I find the township building, and I walk inside, and there's three ladies sitting there. And it's I guess I was there in, that was probably late January. And they've got their little heaters going, and they're talking, and they're doing their work. And I, you know, walk up, and they say, can we help you? And I said, well, hi, I'm from the East Coast, and I was born and raised here, but I'm here to write a book and do some research, and I'm here because I'm looking for the underwater UFO base. They just kind of looked at me with, you know, these slack-jawed stares, and uh-huh. said, well, we've never heard of a UFO base around here. And I said, well, that's just the research. I said, if you can direct me to it, that's great. If not, well, you know, I understand. So they called the chief of police. And they said, no, we've never heard of anything like that. We had, you know, maybe a couple reports of lights, but that's the only thing. So they said, but there's a strange thing up on top of the hill. They said, they pointed me to an old house that was part of the underground railroad back in the middle of the 19th century. So yeah. I did get a little bit of weirdness there, but it's interesting the reactions you get from people when you just walk up on them cold. And you ask where the UFO base is.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. They, you know, that happens. I do that here. I kind of shock people. So have you seen any UFOs up here? You know, they just look at me, and they look at me kind of sideways at first, and they go, well, yeah, but I don't know if I should talk about it, you know, because they have. And one of the funniest things that happened up here, July, I think it was 23rd of last year, is that we had the Baptist church and the there's a big Jonah Ministries place. They had a huge camp out going on because they took over the old school, and you know, big gathering, big camp out, everybody outside, you know, doing their thing, and these four ships come in. And there was, they look, a triangle with one trailing is what it looked like. And then all of a sudden the triangle actually lined up, you know, straight up and down, and just hovered, you know, right over the where they're having their big camp out there. And then one of them went over to Flat Top Mountain and did something over there. We don't know. And then it finally it returned, and then they took off. But they were there for a good 20 minutes. Undeniable, brilliant, kind of pinkish red lights, very bright.
Yeah.
And sat there for 20 minutes, didn't move, you know, held perfect formation straight up and down. You know, we were watching them. We actually got some footage of them. We got some photographs of them. But after the event, you know, we walked over and started asking people there, hey, did you guys see that? You know, did you see anything? And they're all going, no, no. You know, they're really afraid to talk about it.
Yeah. And well, you know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking, you know, I'm listening to your story and I'm starting to get sensations of it. And in all honesty, I mean, I've seen a lot of scary things. I've done a lot of scary things. And I'd like to think that I'm not a sissy, but I think that if I were confronted with a circumstance like that where I thought it was genuinely an alien visitor hovering over me, I don't know that I'd be able to move. I think it would scare the hell out of me.
You know, it's funny, though, that is what happens here. We're doing some Native American ceremony here and had a lot of elders, and we're doing a sweat lodge, and one of the chiefs here that was actually running the sweat lodge, he was a Lakota chief. We were talking about it, and he said, you know, don't be surprised if you come out of the lodge and you might be seeing something in the sky, because they seem to come when we do this ceremony. And, you know, there was this woman that was part of it, and she's going, I want them to land. I want to get on the ship, you know. And she was saying, mm-hmm. I want them down here on the ground, and I want to get on the ship. And so she was doing her thing. And so, you know, we finished the ceremony, and we come outside, and sure enough, here's this big gold ship flying right over the lodge, you know. And guess who was the first one to run and grab a tree?
Yeah.
was the one screaming the loudest, you know. They better land.
It shows that she ultimately had good sense.
Yeah. And there we had another guy here who was really good. Loved this guy, a great friend of mine. And he was Korean, very connected, let's say, you know, even part of the royal family over there. But he was here. And he said, you know, I'm not going to go public and talk about this unless they come down really low. And he's got a $7,000 camera on his shoulder, you know, this really nice camera.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, we're out there and we have this big burn pile going. We're burning a bunch of the branches in here, cleaning up the ranch. And these three ships come in. And one of them drops right down really low, right over us, and flies right over us. And I'm sitting there watching the ships, you know, and I look at him and I see him just frozen, with his mouth wide open, frozen, just stuck.
Right.
And I said his name twice and he didn't even move. You know, he didn't even look at me. And finally he turns around and looked at me and I pointed at the camera on his shoulder, you know, strapped to his shoulder. And he just goes, oh, my God, you know. And he was very upset, you know, and I said, don't worry about it. I go, that's. And, you know, this guy was a Qigong and like a Kung Fu master and fearless, you know, just a very spiritual guy. And watching, you know, that's a normal reaction. You know, people don't need to beat themselves up over it. But when you see something that bizarre and you can't explain it, and, you know, it's your mind does kind of go into almost a freeze mode, like all your senses are just tuned into this and your attention's on it 100% and you don't even know anything else going on around you.
Yeah, I think intuitively also you look at something like it and you think, well, if they can build a ship that does that, they can probably do whatever they want with me. So you would feel defenseless.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the fascination with UFOs, you know, globally, it absolutely makes sense that we want to understand it. But in all honesty, I don't think the human race is ready to interact with anybody from another planet. I mean, we can't get along with ourselves, let alone, you know, someone from another, you know, part of the galaxy or from another galaxy. So I think if they landed, we might get along with them for a little while until the novelty wore off. Then we'd want what they had, and then they'd take offense, and then it would get ugly.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much that seems to be the standard approach, you know, shoot them down, steal the technology, dissect them. You know, but, you know, we really haven't been been too gracious with any of the other indigenous cultures here on the planet. You know, I don't know why we would do anything different with somebody from off world.
Yeah. No, the only way we would behave ourselves if it was absolutely obvious that they could do whatever they wanted with us, then we'd be
good. You know, it seems like, I tell you what, we've got some footage here that's just hilarious. And I don't know if it was hilarious for the pilot because we don't know what happened. But we had a very, very large UFO come in and multiple witnesses on the ground. I don't know how many were on the ground, probably 15, 20 people. And a camera crew was here doing a documentary. Well, this UFO just goes cruising towards the moon. Very big, just one giant solid light going towards the moon. And then we've got this, like, some kind of a – I couldn't tell what it was because it was nighttime, but it was some kind of F-15, 16, something like that. Just afterburners on going after this going after this UFO. And then all of a sudden I'm watching the whole event, and all of a sudden you don't hear anything. The jet's totally silent. No lights, no jet, nothing. It was very, very loud as it was going towards this object. Right. And we were watching it, you know, vectoring in on the object, and it just vanished. It totally disappeared. So have no idea what happened there. And then the next day, we had three F-16s come over. One guy was turning his cockpit sideways. I was looking right up at him in his jet. I mean, I could see his helmet and everything. They came over and did several, you know, two passes over the ranch, nice and low, and did a couple more in the area, and then left.
Your area, are those routine military training routes or?
No, they're not. Basically, it's really weird to have that happen, but for them to circle around, and we've had them actually come in and right on top of the ranch, they'll just hit the afterburners and go straight up, you know, and just shake up the ranch pretty good. We've had them do treetop level maneuvers here, and I'm trying to think of is it Warthog? The Warthogs. We had some Warthogs go through here. I was going to go on coast to coast that night. And I thought it was quite interesting because we had these Warthogs fly right over the ranch, and they tipped their wings up and showed these big old bombs on the bottom of the wings. You know, yeah. I don't know if they're just having fun or they're into coast to coast, or I don't know what their agenda was, but it's very obvious that they were, making a presence known.
Yeah, well, honestly, I mean, you know, guys like that fly those kind of airplanes. When they get an opportunity to play, they will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an incredible toy to play with. And so it wouldn't surprise me if that's what they're doing. But you might look and see if any of the people on the town council have friends in the Air Force. Maybe they're saying, yeah. Hey, that guy out there on that farm, go out there and buzz his property.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we do have a lot of listeners to the show, believe it or not. And on Coast to Coast, when I go on Coast to Coast, you know, we had a little thing on our website, seeing how many people hit the website, and it was amazing. You would see McCord, which is one of the closest bases here, just hitting it constantly. But I really think these other three F-16s were looking for the one that disappeared.
Yeah,
that was my feeling, because they kept circling and circling, and it was the day after that event happened.
Right.
But, I mean, all I can say is that's what we experienced. All of us saw the same thing. I don't know where the jet went. I can't really say anything other than it was totally visible. It was very loud with its lights on, and it was a full moon night. It was going towards us, and you could see it even if it turned its lights off. You could still see it. There was nothing. I mean, yeah. It vanished.
Yeah, well – When a terrestrial jet, especially a military fighter, when they go to the silent mode, that's normally not good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I know they have some stealth capabilities, some of the jets. They can go pretty quiet. But I mean, this was you didn't hear a thing. Yeah. I mean, it was you heard the crickets.
Yeah, but really, what I was implying is that their silent mode is that their engines have quit.
Yeah, that's what I was figuring. You know, but yeah, I don't know what kind of stealth capabilities they have. I know the helicopters can be pretty quiet, you know, sometimes if they want to be. Yeah. And we do get a lot of that. We get a lot of black helicopters flying over here, and some are those Blackhawks with some funny gear on the bottom, you know, that I've never seen before. And I had a guy in the Air Force, a friend of mine, and he was here, and he saw this one flying around. And I said, "Who are those guys?" And he says, "You know, we don't know who they are because when they land, we can't go near them.
Right.
They fuel themselves. And they have a lot of high-tech equipment on, and we can't go near them. They have carte blanche. They land, they fuel themselves. Nobody can go near them, and they take off." And
yeah, they're one of those governmental entities that has no name.
Yeah, they sure hate to be videotaped because we videotape them and put it on YouTube right away. You know, so that's how we stop it. You know, we just, as soon as I hear one, I've got my camera and I'm running out in the middle of the field filming it, you know. But, I mean, I've seen a mole on one of the pilots' faces. That's how close they've come, you know, with some of their little runs, like intimidation runs. But I think with me, the difference with me is I've already died a couple times. I mean, I had a severe drowning when I was 25.
Wow.
And I've already crossed over, so that fear of death, I mean, I like everybody, I want to live, but the fear of death just isn't there. And so, you know, when they come, I'm like running out in the field with my camera, you know, trying to get some good footage.
Right.
You know,
it sounds like you live in a very, very active area.
Yeah, it is. You know, I can, even last night I went out, I have a paranormal investigator here. And a couple other people were all sitting outside. And I said, "Okay, what's that? What's that?" I go, "Look, there's another one. There's another one." And then the space station goes by and they get all excited. I go, "No, that's the space station. But look at that thing following it. You know, what is following it?" And we've actually filmed these objects, pretty large objects following the space station, very close to it.
Yeah.
And I had a geophysicist here that actually filmed it. And he got on the horn. He had some connection, made some calls, and he said, "Hey, do you have anything up there following the space station?" And he goes, "I know the shuttle's not up. It's on the ground. Is there Russian anything, you know, Russian ship or something docking, you know, bringing supplies to the space station?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, it's funny you said that because we have some very good footage of an object flying right behind the space station, very right. close proximity," right. and then all of a sudden, we do have a Russian. You know, they come up with a story. Oh no, there is a Russian, you know, something docking with it.
Well, you know, they put that thing up there to do business, and you know, all kinds of business and all kinds of experimentation, and so there's got to be things that go up there and linger by it. And but I mean, the orbital ephemeris. I mean, there's over 10,000 cataloged things orbiting the Earth. So yeah. It's that's the ones that they've cataloged. That doesn't include the small debris and the screws and whatnot that they've lost control of. It's just, you know, it's become a junkyard up there. So, you know, the things that you can see that will, you know, will reflect light and fool the eye and make you wonder, a lot of it is just junk that we put up in space. Mm-hmm. You know, mankind just can't stop putting junk wherever we go.
Yeah. We a lot of times we use Heavens Above and then the JPL site, you know, to check and see what we're looking at up there.
Right.
See if it is a visible satellite or something of that nature. But we don't even catalog anything unless it does something really anomalous, you know, like it'll make a big turn or it'll respond to the people here on the ground or do something, you know, very significant that shows it's not, you know, just a satellite.
Right.
I don't know satellites that can stop and then or make a right angle turn and then, you know, flip over and, you know, giant triangles that'll come and flip over and go make a right angle turn, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to tell us we had a – go ahead.
Satellites can be retasked. They can move about. They can change their orbit altitude. They can move quite liberally, but they don't have high performance like you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, some of the things. We have some real nice gear here. We use the third-generation military night vision goggles hooked to a camera. Right. And so we can see things that most people can't. There's some pretty crazy stuff up there. And I notice what's interesting is when these things fly by each other, they signal. You know, they'll flash really bright when they get into close proximity of each other. And to me, I don't know. I mean, I know there's iridium flares that'll do that, that they'll throw off a pretty big flash. But we've seen that over and over, that if something's coming too close or in a close proximity, you know, the one of the objects will flash or both will flash each other, depending on what it is. Hmm. You know, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, well, you've seen a lot of things that I find fascinating that I haven't seen, so I'm envious. But
well, you have to come up and write a book, Weird Washington.
It's already been done.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've done about 30 states now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering, because Washington has some crazy things. We have one of the most interesting things here, you know, putting my credibility on the line. Actually, I've seen a Bigfoot. I've had my own experience up here because I do spend a lot of time in the forest, in the woods. But there's something up here that's being seen on a regular basis, which is quite interesting. And I've interviewed at least 12 people that have seen it. And including one was a police officer, and one guy drove his car off the road because this thing was sitting in the middle of the road eating some roadkill. But there's this pterodactyl type creature that people are seeing up here, and a pilot actually witnessed as well. So there's been some real credible sightings of this thing, and it's not the typical pterodactyl. It's that one, can't think of the name of it, but it has might be like a pterosaurus or something like that, but it has the ball at the end of its tail. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that one, the prehistoric? There's this thing flying around here, and I know people that don't even want to talk about it that have seen it, and they just said I don't, you know, and I believe them, you know, because they're saying I saw this thing, and they give the same description. It had a ball at the end of its tail, had leathery wings, like bat, more like bat type wings. Had the head, you know, and it was very, very big, very large, and every once in a while we'll hear this screeching. It sounds like you're in Jurassic Park or something like that. It's this sound. I can't even explain it. I mean, I've heard cougars mating. I've heard bear. I've heard everything here. I have never heard anything like this sound. And yeah. It's just a very, very extremely loud sound that sounds like some kind of a bird, you know, a very, very large bird, but making this noise. You know, it's quite interesting. This thing seems to be flying around in our air. It's been seen as far as the Olympic Forest. It's been seen flying around this area around Mount Adams, and you know, I don't know what this thing is. I have no idea, but it does fit the fossil records of that one prehistoric bird that has the big the ball at the end of its tail.
Yeah, well, there's so much that we haven't discovered. There's so much that's out there that just waiting to be found, and I think we're probably going to continue to find things for, you know, probably centuries that amaze us. And, you know, for whatever reasons, they've been able to, you know, remain isolated from humankind. So it's, and probably with good reason.
Yeah, there's some stories is up here with the tribal police have seen all kinds of, UFO activity and crazy things. But some of the most interesting stories I've heard them talk about were, they call them the stick people. And they're these really small people they see running around in the forest, and they always have bundles of sticks. They're gathering sticks and other things, but they're really small. And they'll see them just running across a road really quick, and they'll stop, and it'll be a clear prairie area. And they'll run right in front of them. They stop and get out of their car, and there's nothing there. They don't know where they went, or, there's a lot of stories about that. And then they stories about this other creature. The only way I can explain it is it looks kind of like Yoda out of Star Wars. And they see it up in the trees, and several people have seen it. And these are, officers. They weren't drunk or anything. These are tribal police, sergeants and things like that. And have seen this thing, and their grandfathers have told them about it. And they said, when you see this thing, it has big yellow eyes, and it looks kind of like a Yoda. They sit up in the trees, and they said, when you see one, don't look at it. They said, whatever you do, don't look at it. Just turn away and mind your business and walk away, because they said it has some ability. If you stare at it, it has a, some kind of ability. I don't know what. Some kind of mind mill ability or something. But it's funny you hear these stories, and this area is just a real crazy place. I mean, there's just so much activity, and the American Academy of Science actually did a huge research study up here on all the Bigfoot sightings here, and very extensive study. You look at the questionnaire, and the first thing they asked was, okay, what did it look like? What color was its hair? Was there anything different about its head, about its body type, about the way it walked, whatever? And then they get down to, were you drinking? Are you on any medication? Do you wear glasses? Do you very, very detailed information on it, to kind of weed out the people that
Sure.
were, really drunk and shooting at things in the forest at night,
Well, I mean, if you're going to be an
Yeah.
investigator, I mean, you want to get past all that. So, those
Yeah.
are, unfortunately, those are inevitable questions,
Yeah. So I mean, very, very, very good questions. Some of the people they're interviewing were very well-known people. They're very sophisticated, very educated people. And what was interesting is that the descriptions that they gave, down to details, where one of the details they said it just didn't seem to have a neck. Its head was very close to its shoulders. It was very large. The color of them differed from some older silver-haired ones to light brown to dark brown. Fur, and the size is different too, and it went anywhere from, seven plus feet tall, to smaller ones that are maybe only like 6 feet tall or so. But and babies, they've seen babies as well, like smaller little babies running along behind the mothers or whatever. But yeah, it's a lot of activity in this area. A lot of research has been done out here.
Yeah, in the Carpenter Cemetery in that's very in the southeastern part of Missouri. There's a story about a floating blue baby, and I discovered that particular story by doing what I had. I became my mode of operation was to talk to every hotel clerk and every waitress that I ran into and everybody that was pumping gas. Just ask them where anything interesting or strange or odd would be in the state, and I always got some kind of a lead to go check this out. So this girl told me, this hotel clerk told me about a floating blue baby that she had seen when in high school. It was a ritual where they would take the boys would take their girlfriends out to the cemetery at midnight, and they would swing their car lights out and shine them across the tombstones. And she mm-hmm. said that there was mist hanging across all the tombstones, and that you could see this little blue, she said it was obviously this little blue floating baby just moving all around in the mist. And she said it scared her so bad, she was, you know, screaming at her boyfriend to leave, and she said she finally got him to go, and she never went back. So it was a very frightening thing for her. But I went out to the cemetery, I went out there in daylight, and it is the kind of an atmosphere where you have to drive this little dirt road that goes out through a bunch of trees, and it is very isolated. And if you take, you know, a teenage girl out there at midnight and she's in the frame of mind where she thinks she's going to see something spooky, she's going to see something spooky. And if you get the right atmospheric conditions, you get the mist floating over, you know, the tombstones and throughout the cemetery, and the headlights shine through the mist, and you get all kinds of refraction going on, you can just easily visualize how, you know, something like that could happen. But then you could also maybe think, well, maybe there is some kind of a captured energy force out there, you know, the spirit or soul of some entity trapped out in that cemetery boundary somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny it's tricky to figure out if you have a story that's just been passed down over and over and a lot of overactive imaginations, or is this same thing appearing over and over and people are actually, you know, seeing it.
Right. Yeah, in 1978, there was an extreme, about a three-month period in a town called Ellsbury, which is about 40 miles north of St. Louis, right along the Mississippi River, the Mississippi River. And it drew national attention. The local media were there. They camped out there for like 3 months. And people all through the town were seeing things that they couldn't explain, and they were hearing things. Cattle were being mutilated. And one particular farmer who had a fairly large inventory of cattle was out doing a count of his cattle, and he was missing a couple of them. So he started to expand his search. And in one of his pastures, in the middle of the pasture, was a single tree, a lone tree. And the cows were known to go out and congregate under the tree to get into the shade when it was a hot day. So he went out to the tree and he saw a cow laying down up there. And when he got closer, he realized that the cow was dead, because the cow was flat on its back, legs all splayed out, had been split down the middle, had been gutted. And he went up to the animal to learn what was there. And he found that the animal was surrounded by branches and twigs. And on all of these branches and these small twigs were thousands of bluehead flies that had been somehow bonded to the wood. He said it was like they'd been superheated and plasticized. They became part of the branches. And he looked straight up through the tree, and here was a clear path where this cow had fallen through the tree. And so Ellsbury was a very active place, and it's like you say, it gained national attention for about a period of 3 months.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. There's it seems like over and over and over, there's a lot of stories about cattle mutilations and a lot of different theories about them as well.
It is common, and it's common everywhere that there seem to be UFO reports. You know, I guess where there's smoke, there's fire, but you know why?
Yeah, would you be interested in taking a few callers?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to.
All right, great. We'll see what we've got on the line here. So far there's nothing on the line, but we haven't put the numbers out, but we're going to open up the lines for callers if anybody wants to ask James any questions about Weird Missouri or any of the other experiences he's had. So we're going to give the numbers, so grab your pencil or your pen. The first number is 888-627-6008, and the next number is 530-413-4522 or 530-413-5011. That number is 888-627-6008 or 530-413-4522. But check out those numbers and feel free to give us a call if you have any questions or anything to share, any other experiences that you might have had. So now that we've given out the call numbers, we're probably going to have a few people popping in on us here. We can go on, though, if you've got some other good stories about weird Missouri. I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about the really small stick people, and how stories can be, you know, embellished, and they grow over years, and it's difficult to, you know, to separate the wheat from the chaff. But in Sikeston, Missouri, which is also southeast Missouri, there's a story about a school bus that was stalled on a train track. And I actually went to and found the specific train track, the specific intersection. And I took a look at it and thought, well, it's very easy to understand how an accident could happen here between a vehicle and a train. And evidently, a school bus stalled, a train broadsided it, and killed a bunch of small children. This is about 40 years ago. And now what people do is they take their dirty cars, will work just as well as a car covered with talcum powder. But if your car is clean, you need to cover it with some kind of a fine filtered dust, and talcum powder seems to be the choice. And you take your car out there, again, at midnight, and you turn it off, you park it on the tracks, you turn it off, and you just sit there and wait. And the story goes that if you sit there and wait, all of a sudden, tiny little handprints will start to appear in either the dirt or the talcum powder on your car. So, again, you know, little people in roads. But yeah. I got to tell you, if that happened to me, I'd start my car and I'd leave.
You know, it'd be interesting is to, I know there's ways. I mean, here we have a lot of fun. We use technology, and we have some technology called PIP technology, where they separate the whole magnetic light spectrum, and you can see anything changes, anything moving, you know, infrared technology. And then we use infrared spotlights along with the night vision.
Right.
And it'll light up anything happening in the next dimension, you know, any kind of activity or whatever. But it would be neat to try to utilize some of that technology. You know, take the old car and put it there and try, you know, all the different technologies and see if anything shows up.
It would seem to be the prime location to do that.
Or even, I know some cases, if you have a really high-speed camera and you film an event like that and then slow it down, you know, you'll start seeing some pretty crazy things. But they're having a little, looks like we're having a little trouble communicating with the station, but I think that's straightened out.
Okay.
But we can go on further. Is there, you know, any further stories that I know the you're probably running out of stories? Or
no. Actually, I could literally, we could talk about this all night long. My voice would fail, but we could talk about this literally through the night hours. I mean, there's all kinds of weirdness in Missouri. You know, the St. Louis Arch is a world famous structure. And as a young teenager, I got to watch it. Well, I didn't, you know, see it all the time, but I got to see it frequently enough to watch it start from its, you know, its beneath the surface, you know, beginnings to the completion of the arch. And the arch is the world's largest single purpose order of stainless steel. There's a lot of stainless steel. It's an amazing structure, and it is a magnet for weirdos, for thrill seekers. Mm-hmm. And going back to about, I was probably 13, 14 years old, the first airplane was flown through the legs of the arch, and they flew from the Illinois side to the Missouri side. And because this person was the first one to do it, got away with it completely. And but that prompted the St. Louis authorities to put cameras on the legs of the arch. So, but that didn't stop. That didn't stop people from flying through it. Four or five other people did fly through it over the years, and they would cover over the identification numbers on their airplane. They'd cover over the window so that they could, you know, so people couldn't take a picture of them, and they'd fly through. And it also attracted a fellow who tried to skydive and land on the top of it. He opened his parachute trying to land. The intention was to land on the very top of it, to jettison his main parachute and then jump off and use his reserve parachute to complete his stunt. Unfortunately, he didn't land on top. He landed on the side of the arch, and he slid down the side of the arch with his wife on the ground filming it. And unfortunately, he died in that particular stunt. So after that, a guy named, he actually had the formal name of Suction Cup Man, decided he was going to climb the arch using suction cups. And he had suction cups on his hands and his knees and his feet. And he actually climbed right on up, had no problem getting to the top. And then he did jump off using a parachute. And he was arrested, and they gave him some kind of a fine and a 90-day probation. And then he went ahead and did something really stupid again during the probation. And he went back before the same judge that he put him on probation for the arch stunt. And just like, you can't figure people like that out. And Missouri is an amazing place. It's just like Washington. If you buy a copy of Weird Washington, you're going to find that there's things that's probably fairly close to you that you aren't aware of that are really weird, really strange, and amazing. I mean, I met amazing people. Weird Missouri is not about all of the bizarre, strange, and unusual things. It's also about extraordinary things like, you know, the cave that was discovered on the morning of 9/11. And I met some very interesting people that I wrote about. Half of what's in the book, I submitted twice as many stories that are actually in the book. And a couple of the most interesting people didn't make the cut. But I met a fellow named Catfish George. His name is actually George. I don't know if it's his last name, but he loves to go by Catfish. He's about 70 years old. And I discovered him because it was towards the end of my time out there. It was a warm day. I went into a little convenience store to get a bottle of water. And when I walked in on the sidewalk out in front of the store was an adult-sized tricycle, and had a basket on it. It had an American flag, a big American flag, and a big Marine Corps flag, and a POW flag. And then taped onto the basket were all these pieces of artboard that said that he was the world's most experienced traveling average man. That's the way he described himself. And he had 148 crossings in the international dateline and 747s. He had more time in 747s than most CEOs. And he explained how he did all his traveling. And I thought, well, this is quite a character. I'd like to meet this guy. So I went in, I got my water, and I said, could you tell me who belongs to that tricycle up front? And I said, that's Catfish George. He's probably around back. So I went around back. I didn't see him. So I went back in. I didn't have time to hang around. So I went back in. I left my business card, and I said, listen, I'm writing a book about Missouri. I'd like to talk to him, and I'll be back at 8 o'clock in the morning. Tell him if he wants to talk to me, I'll be here, and you know, hopefully we'll meet. I go back the next morning. He's there waiting. He's got photo albums. He wants to show me everything he's ever done. And he's a 70-year-old guy at the time, and he dresses like Johnny Cash, all black, head to toe. And he wears this big leather floppy hat that, you know, it would be very good in a rainstorm, but it's covered with bumper stickers and decals and all these pins from places that he's been and things he believes in. His whole clothing is covered that way. And he is just naturally, he has a voice that's just incredibly powerful. His normal speaking voice will just knock you over. So because of the way he looks, the way he, you know, transports himself around, the way he talks, he's off-putting to people. You know, the people that drive Mercedes and BMWs, they give him a wide berth. And but he and I met. We shook hands. He starts to tell me about himself. And in 5 minutes, I understood him. And 10 minutes into it, I was protective of him. I fell in love with the guy. And he's the prototype Missouri hillbilly. He was born deep in the Ozark Mountains in a log cabin, no indoor plumbing. He and I shared that same commonality. I didn't have any indoor plumbing or water until I was 10 years old. He had that same kind of a starting point, but even, you know, 20 years before I did. So his whole thing was that he went through high school and he went to the Marine Corps and he learned to weld. His entire adult professional life, he never made more than $10 an hour. But yet he's traveled to 66 countries, many of them many times. He's been to Australia 20 times. He's done all of these incredible things, and he's done it on a $10 an hour wage. And people think that he's being braggadocious with all of his signage about, I've done this, I've done that. But what he's really trying to do, he's trying to show people that, hey, look, I'm this guy born in the dirt poor circumstance that I was. I've never made more than $10 an hour. But look where I've traveled. Aren't you happy for me? Can I share it with you? He wasn't trying to be, you know, a big shot. He was just trying to share experiences that he never thought he would experience. And he was just this innocent soul who was completely misunderstood, but somebody that I was so glad to have met. And over the past 4 years, he and I have shared countless correspondence through the normal, you know, U.S. Postal Service. And I've got a box. I've saved every letter he ever sent me. I've got over 250 letters from the guy. So it was just an amazing process to go out to Missouri and meet all of these people and see all these things. And Washington would be exactly the same way. I'm sure that you could spend, you know, the same amount of time I did, drive the same amount of mileage, meet all those people, and you'd be amazed at the people that are in your state.
Oh yeah, I know a few here that you know, they're basically mountain men. You know, right. They have one guy actually wrote a book, Mountain Man Philosophy, and it's pretty good. You know, I think we could use it today, especially if we've forgotten a lot of the basics in everyday society. But there's just all kinds of people here and very interesting people and people that have been around the block and live kind of a hermetic life now.
Right. Well, you know, people who have been around the block, you know, I think the smart ones, the honest ones, the ones that can look within themselves and are introspective and they start to, you know, understand what life can be about, they reject all of the superficial nonsense and they do go back and revert back to the basics. And I think it's much easier, it's much happier to be, you know, a happy person, easier to be a happy person if you do live like that. And I think you might be an example of that. I mean, you've rejected television for 30 years and you're happier for it.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things that I've rejected. You know, I've gotten some pretty fat checks by people that, you know, wanted to do my life story and things like that. But, you know, I won't mention the names, but the people that were involved, I didn't want them to do it. I just said, you wouldn't do it justice. You would, you know, turn it into an action adventure thing and make it all fearful and suspenseful. And that's not the story, you know, not the story I want to get out there. So, you know, they, you know, a typical is look what they did with Fire in the Sky, you know, with that story. You know, you talk to Travis Walton and it's nothing. The movie is so far off from what really happened.
Sure.
You know, that, you know, it's sad when Hollywood gets a hold of things. But, you know, I just said, you know, take your money. I don't care. You know,
right. You know, you know, talk about Hollywood changing things. I mean, The Exorcist, the movie The Exorcist, is the classic example of that. The exorcism actually took place in Hazelwood, Missouri, which is a little bit north of St. Louis. And the story with the exorcist began in Maryland. And the real story doesn't involve a teenage girl. It involves a teenage boy. And a family had this son who was exhibiting all of the symptoms that were in the movie. And, you know, they didn't know what to do. They were Catholic. They approached the Baltimore Archdiocese, say, we have a real problem. Can you do something? Can you perform an exorcism? They agreed to attempt it. The attempt failed. And the family, out of desperation, moved to St. Louis. Why they moved to St. Louis, I don't really know specifically, but that was their next destination. And their son continued to have these problems, and they approached the St. Louis Archdiocese. And they said, yeah, we'll help you. And they were successful, but unlike the movie, where it was, you know, this intense thing that happened in a bedroom in just, you know, a few, you know, minutes or hours or something, the real exorcism took months. And it was successful. The boy, you know, reverted back to a normal life, finished Catholic high school, got married, had three children, and I'm told became an airline pilot. So I may have flown with him. But
I'd see him being taken over while I'm on board. You know, that wouldn't be a good idea.
I won't tell you any pilot stories.
I'd hate to look up at the front and see my pilot step out of the cockpit and his head do a 360.
That would be a
you know, and along with other things. But,
you know, if they told your life story, they would do with it what Hollywood does with every story. You know, they make it what they believe to be saleable.
Yeah, and it's you know, they even the people at Paranormal State said that. I mean, they came out here and they did their show, and they kind of you know, the producer told me that. He said, you know, we're not going to be on the air or be able to sell this thing or stay in business unless we follow the basic pattern. you know, boy meets girl, boy saves girl, or girl saves boy, or you got to have it scare, you got to have a threat.
Well, you've been in a car chase or two, haven't you?
Yeah.
Pretty good. That's one of the basic ingredients for any Hollywood movie, a car chase.
Yeah. Yeah. We had this really fun, we've had funny things happen here where I knew we were being followed. And I was with this woman, we were driving down this mountain road, and so I told her, we're going along and this guy was following me. And so I said, I go, hey, just pull over to the side of the road. And so the guy goes over, guy passes us, and you know, he passes and he's looking over, trying to act like nonchalant, looking over at us and everything. So we go ahead and we're behind him now. I said, so take off, follow this. So we're behind him now. And I said, look, right up here, turn right, but don't put your blinker on. Cause there's a crossroad here. He's either going to have to go straight and go up into White Salmon or turn right and go down this extension 141 to the highway. There's only two options here. I said, but don't turn until the last minute, because he was right in front of us. And so we're going along and he's slowing down and we get up to the thing and we act like we're going straight and then we turn right. And the guy hits his brakes, you know, then does this total turnaround, you know, and comes back up behind us again. And I had to pull over in these trees. And as he was trying to catch us, he goes flying by us, and we pulled out again and we're on his tail. It was just hilarious, but we were just playing with this guy. And then so we had to go across the bridge, and he was behind us again, and I paid his bridge toll. You know, this is for the guy behind us, like this. And then I could see him just shaking his head. You know, I was looking back at him, and he's in the mirror. I was watching him, and he was just shaking his head. And then he got on the highway and just left.
I can already see it in the movie now.
yeah, but it was pretty funny. I was just having fun with it. I didn't feel threatened by it, but. You know, you could definitely tell, you know, when you have a black BMW following you, they're probably, you know, have an agenda. But anyway, that's about, you know, that's about the only car chase, you know, scene that I can think of. But it wasn't really so much of a chase, but it was just really funny, just messing with it.
But if you tell them that story, by the time they're done with it, there'll be four or five vehicles involved, and two or three of them will roll over, and it'll be
the shots fired and a few other things. That's basically what they do, you know. Unfortunately, but yeah, they I could just see it, because the person involved, he's a very famous actor actually that wanted to do it, and I just saw. I go, boy, I know where this is going to go. This is going to go right into a shoot 'em up adventure film, you know, it's nothing about what I want to be involved in. But anyway, I had the check up on my wall, you know, with a little pen through it just to remind me, you know. But, you know, people think about that, I tell people it's not the money, you know, it's not the money. It's about, you know, to me, it's about being an honor and telling the truth. And if people don't want to hear that, then I don't want to tell it and I don't want to be involved in it. You know, it's that simple. But I know, I guess fire, what's his name? Travis Walton is trying to come out with the real story, and he has some people interested, and I guess they're going to redo the, call it something else, and you know, come out with the real story about what happened. You know, I thought it was pretty interesting that some of the people in that story that were with him, I guess some of the people that worked with him, were actually bribed to lie, to change their story by, what was his name, Phil Klass or something like that? One of the big skeptical UFO debunkers, I guess, threw some cash down to try to debunk it, trying to figure out a way to debunk that story.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that name, but
yeah, he's just one of the ones that, you know, when you have trained police officers following a ship, you know, and multiple witnesses, and he goes, oh, they mistook Venus. You know, that was his major story. It was Venus. Every time a major sighting came up, oh, they saw Venus and got excited for it.
Venus can be pretty impressive.
Boy, it is right now. We're looking at our sky. It's just huge. I mean, it is so lit up. It's amazing.
Yep.
But, you know, it's there every night. So, you know, I always tell people they see this big, bright object in the sky. And I go, well, go out tomorrow night at the same time and see if it's still there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times it is. You know? And I go, well, if it's in the same place at the same time, odds are it's probably Jupiter or Venus or one of the other major planets, major stars.
Right.
It could be Cassini or something of that nature.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting close to the end of the hour here, so we're going to have to wrap things up.
Sure.
But before we do, I wanted to make sure and give any contact information so you can, you know, get people in touch with you and you know, get a hold of your books or anything else you have to offer.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, anybody that wants to buy a copy of Weird Missouri, you can buy it at Amazon, or you can go to www.weirdmissouri.com. That'll lead you to a link where you can buy it. But Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you'll get it in 2 or 3 days. Deja Vu All Over Again, that's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Infinity Publishing. It's available in hardbacks, paperback, and the ebook. And my next novel, Thomas Jefferson Is Missing, that'll be out in early 2013. And James, I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's been a fun 2 hours.
Oh, great. Yeah. It's too bad they already wrote Weird Washington, because we could point you in the direction of just all kinds of crazy things and you know, some very major people involved. I mean, we had Robert Salas here that was at Malmstrom, you know, when they shut down the missile silos there.
Right.
He was here and he observed some crazy things, some big green lights flying all around the mountain. And, you know, he'll go on record. All the exopolitics people have been up here. You know, we just had Bob Dean up here you know, just a huge list of people that have come up here and actually witness themselves, you know, the activity going on. But, you know, the list is very long, but we probably are one of the most censored UFO hotspots on the planet.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I was unaware that you guys had that much weirdness there. But, yeah, weird. Well, there's, you know, if there's that much weirdness in your state, then there's probably enough for a sequel. Weird
oh,
Washington,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
maybe you could just call it Strange Washington or something and come out with it. But anyway, again, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and keep up the good work and keep watching the skies, because some pretty crazy stuff is going down lately.
Undoubtedly. Hey, thank you, James.
All right. Well, have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, we're reaching the end of the hour here, getting ready to sign off, folks. Have a great evening. Watch the skies. It's getting real interesting up there. And pay attention to everything going down, because we are going through major social, economic, and physical earth changes, as well as being visited by off-world beings that are pretty undeniable now. They're being seen all around the world. So anyway, stay tuned, and we'll see you next Saturday. Have a good evening.